I'm Lauren Sega, Manager of Communications for Homeport, a nonprofit affordable housing developer in Central Ohio. We're in one of the fastest growing areas in the country, and while we've seen the growth, we've felt the pains that come along with it, especially when it comes to housing all of us and our incoming neighbors. Each month, we're interviewing local experts on the issues, the barriers, and the solutions around housing and development, hoping to shed some light on how we got where we are and what we can do to create a future that houses everyone. This is Level With Us. For this episode, I sat down with Michael Corey, CEO of the Human Service Chamber of Franklin County, and Jill Guinan, Resident Services Program Manager for Homeport. We're getting a macro and micro view of the impact of nonprofit work and the factors that decide how far that work can extend, how it's prioritized, and how it's funded. Michael and the leaders of the 200 member organizations that the Human Service Chamber serves are coming up against some big challenges: workforce availability, stagnating government and philanthropic funding, and burnout. Jill is just one of the many boots on the ground triaging the lasting effects of the pandemic and inflation. Demand on nonprofits is high, and resources are thinning. Michael and the HSC are doing their best to keep their members informed, connected, and supported with resources, and Jill and the rest of the resident services team are doing the same for Homeport's residents. It's an uphill climb, but as do so many in the field of social work, Michael and Jill remain grounded and optimistic for a turn of the tide. Let's lay the foundation.
Well, when I started in 2017, there were 48 nonprofits, and we got to the pandemic and there were about 80. So we've added over 100% organizations since the pandemic began.
This is Michael Corey. He's been working to make the Central Ohio nonprofit sector stronger, better funded, better informed, and better prepared for what have become increasingly more common, unprecedented events. During our recording, his two-month-old is sleeping nearby, so you may hear him and his sleep sounds. As Michael says later in our conversation, he is a busy human.
And the purpose for everything we've tried to incorporate since the pandemic started is just to be more helpful. We want to fortify the sector and strengthen the sector, and quite frankly, just stabilizing the sector would be fantastic. So everything we're doing and everything we have done has been toward that end. And it's largely predicated on what our folks are telling us they need. We try really hard not to go to our folks and tell them this is what you need. We try to be responsive. We survey our folks a lot. We ask them what they need a lot. And sometimes we can be helpful and sometimes we can't. As proactive as we try to be, we have to be malleable to what our members need and what our community needs.
Right.
And that is both part of the fun and one of the more substantial challenges of this kind of work.
Yeah,
absolutely have to be adaptive and have to be okay with priority shifting from day to day, and so do your partners.
Adapting to needs. That's something Jill Guinan is very familiar with. She and the resident services team check in regularly with our residents to find out where they need help, and they lean on our many partners to connect those residents to the necessary support services.
We're always growing and expanding that. Something that we've really keyed in on in resident services is that there's already a lot of experts in the community and what they're doing. And so instead of trying to bring all of those things in-house and try to be the experts in absolutely everything, we're really becoming the experts in connecting people to what's already out there and bringing those services to our residents. You know, I think in this field, one of the hardest things for some people to learn, but I feel like is really the key, is you can't choose somebody's priorities for them. And so, you know, I could talk to somebody and in, you know, a 15-minute conversation come up with like, oh, I could refer you here and I could get you connected to this and we could do this. And they may have no interest in any of those things and they really did just want me to help them sign up for like a discounted electric service program. Even if I see a bunch of things that I could help with, it's not my job to force them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just about asking. And that's, you know, we did that a lot this year with our resident survey of all of our communities. We had over 500 households respond. to the questions where we just said, hey, you know, what is it like for you living where you are? What is it like with your, you know, property manager? What are the needs in your household? And were you able to find services to meet those or not? Because, you know, on my end, bringing programs and partners and stuff on site, I don't want to just guess. Right. I don't want to, you know, get a bird's eye view of a community and decide for them.
Right.
I really do just, you know, I said, okay, let's just ask and then go from there.
What was the overall response?
The biggest need, unsurprisingly, is financial assistance.
Yeah.
But the second biggest need was food assistance. Even just, you know, from last year, we saw significant increases at our senior housing sites as well as our multifamily communities. We saw a lot more people coming through, and for several months we, you know, had less food than we normally would, and so that was tough. You know, we try to be there to meet the need, but we can only do so much with whatever resources we have at our disposal.
Jill and Homeport's experience is not an anomaly. Need has been on the rise across the nonprofit industry.
We, again, survey our folks a lot, and the last couple of summers we've asked them, how does demand on your agency now compare to 12 months prior? And it just keeps going up. We asked them in June of this year, in advance of a CMC luncheon on the state of nonprofits, what does demand look like? And 92% of them were experiencing higher demand from 12 months prior. We all knew about the food banks across Ohio and the country having record demand, but it was true across the sector, and that caught people's attention. So I thought, well, let me find out for the end of the year how it's looking, because inflation has improved, the economy is really starting to churn now, et cetera, and 85% of our members just told me this week that demand is up from June of 2023.
Why?
So it's primarily an aggregate effect of inflation having consequences for a lot of people that usually aren't in the health and human services system. More people are seeking out help right now because their finances are tight. The other piece of it is the COVID supports have been exhausted. Mm-hmm. So those two factors have driven a lot more people to save money wherever they can or need help wherever they can get it. And that means they're going to the nonprofit sector for assistance.
A lot of people even say we're out of the pandemic or we're back to normal, but that's really just not the reality for so many people. I think especially, you know, a lot of our residents who work in jobs where they don't have much in terms of paid sick leave or even, you know, medical insurance, a lot of those protections for sick leave if you tested positive for COVID or if your children did and they had to stay home from school, the vast majority of those are gone, you know, for, you know, jobs that pay, you know, maybe a barely livable wage. A lot of them just don't have benefits, and so they're either losing their job when they get sick, or they have to go to work sick, or they have to send their kids to school sick, or they lose their job because they have to be home with their kids. And that's frustrating because that's something that I am not able to fix, you know, or solve by myself, or that we can't solve here, you know, as an organization. We can just kind of support people through those problems and processes, but it's frustrating.
And now it's time to level up. With demand on the rise, nonprofits are scrambling to meet it, but they're hogtied. State dollars are hard to get, private funders are experiencing donor fatigue, what used to be competitive wages don't compete anymore, and the workforce is shrinking. Michael and Jill are at the forefront of all of these challenges, and as is the nature of the nonprofit, they're doing the best they can with what they've got.
When we ask our folks what are the biggest drivers of the workforce shortage or workforce challenge, compensation is far and away number one.
Because cost of living is so wildly out of control.
Cost of living is out of control, and expectations for salary and benefits have increased dramatically over the last 3 years, too. And even our agencies that have the most financial flexibility that have increased salary and wages are still not competitive with some of the folks around the sector that have been drawing the talent out.
Like private sector, you mean?
Private sector, as well as the unique nonprofit sector like hospitals.
Okay,
Some of those bigger employers, Amazon, has drawn a lot of people out of our sector altogether because they can pay more. And the adage of, well, you're not going to make as much money in the nonprofit sector, but you're going to feel really good about what you do, you're going to have flexibility, et cetera, that doesn't cut it anymore.
It only goes so far, yeah.
That's right. So that has been happening across the country. The National Council of Nonprofits has published all sorts of data about this occurring everywhere, and no one has a good solution. There just aren't enough healthy people that want to work in our sector or other sectors right now. And we forget about the healthy part. COVID took a lot of people out of the workforce. Childcare is taking a lot of people out of the workforce. And we're still in that post-COVID transition. And a lot of folks have forgotten that. A lot of folks are back to normal, but they forget that there are still residual effects for a lot of people, and our sector is uniquely affected by that.
For a while there, it was all hands on deck for the pandemic. The acute phase of it ended, but so has related funding. People who were financially unstable pre-pandemic have teetered into absolute instability, and many haven't made it out of that hole.
Working as much as we can with the philanthropic and corporate community to help them understand the urgency and keep the dollars flowing in flexible ways as opposed to rigid ways to support the agencies through this moment.
What are
the
barriers to that? Why is it so tough to get?
So it's been an interesting chicken and egg situation. A lot of the philanthropic efforts have been slowed while they've waited to see where all these government dollars go, because they don't want to put money where it would be duplicative.
I see.
And as the government dollars have slowed down, but still with the promise of them coming out, a lot of the philanthropic dollars that could go to certain places have been held back for a minute while we wait to see where a lot of these voluminous dollars go.
The Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Reduction Act are pouring money into the nonprofit sector, but at the end of 2023, they had just begun to flow through various federal grants, and then state and local grants that will become available.
And that will help on some of the infrastructure needs that the sector has, the stuff that isn't as newsworthy, but that is still very important. Homeport knows that better than most. You have buildings.
Mm-hmm.
You have so many buildings that you're working with or that you obviously work out of. And you need a new roof. You need a working HVAC system. Those are very expensive projects that funders tend not to want to pay for, because they want to pay for that child to have roof over their head as opposed to fixing the roof over the building providing that roof.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So a lot of those infrastructure dollars are going to keep flowing because of those two massive pieces of legislation.
Okay.
But there's programmatic needs that aren't being met.
Like admin dollars?
Yes. So we asked our folks in June of 2023, okay, your demand is up at 92% of your organizations. How many of you can meet the needs that you're seeing? 80% said they couldn't meet the need.
Right.
And that's not only because there isn't enough money into this system right now, but enough people to provide the services.
You know, the resident services team has grown since I started back here in January of 22, but our number of residents continues to grow as well. You know, we bring several properties online each year now, which means hundreds of new residents. And so every year that's, you know, maybe a couple hundred more people. We're not growing our resident services team that much every year. And so while we've added, you know, several team members, we've got a nice robust team. And, you know, I would say we do a lot of great work. It always seems like that there's still a lot left to be done. I don't know, in work like this, I feel like there's never enough hands on deck, but we do pretty well with what we have.
Funding is similar. There's never quite enough of it.
And I think a lot of times people want to fund something new and something exciting and something that sounds like it's going to make these really huge, dramatic, quantitative changes, which is great. But most of this type of work isn't that, and I think that can kind of sometimes be a barrier, is you don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel, you just have to be able to afford to keep the wheel moving. And you know, I think that can sometimes be a challenge, is convincing, you know, funders or anybody that we are, you know, we do a really good job with the resources that we have, but we could do so much more, or we could continue to do this if we have, you know, if we get that continued funding.
Some funders get it. Mm-hmm. Some funders absolutely have been spectacular about it and have kept their dollars flexible. Mm-hmm. But a lot of funders that had maybe made their dollars flexible early on in the pandemic are now putting the rigidity back behind them again because they want control of their dollars. And I get it, but it's a little too soon.
So how do you make the case for admin?
The same way they would make the case for admin at their own organizations. And that usually works.
Yeah.
But does it work to the extent of them changing wholesale their philanthropic practices? Not necessarily. When I figure that out, I will have the golden ticket to unleashing resources across the sector. I understand the perspective. I do. But the sector is reliant upon more support than is available, and the government dollars flowing to and through it have not grown commensurate with the need, so we're in this situation.
If we were to solve the funding problem tomorrow, the next barrier would be cutting through the inefficiencies in how people are able to access existing support. You're more likely to get help if you show up in person, but that's a barrier. Add on the paperwork needed and how dispersed our resources are, trying to get help can be a job in itself.
We make accessing existing services too hard. We need to create efficiencies for people. For example, so much is tethered to whether you can show your birth certificate or your driver's license in order to get help. And for a lot of people, that's very, very hard. And then it takes weeks or months to get the identification that you need, and then you have to get back in the system. Or maybe you have to fill out the same information in 8 different places at 8 different times in order to get the help that you need. There are lots and lots of examples like that that our social workers can talk about ad nauseum, where we can make those little systemic tweaks that would have a spectacular effect. Mm-hmm. And they add up in the aggregate to make the system a lot more accessible. A consequence of Columbus's growth and growth downtown in the early 2000s is that there used to be a lot of nonprofits operating in downtown Columbus. Well, as things got more expensive downtown, they moved, as did the people that they served. So now we have the situation where nonprofits, as well as some of the government providing agencies like Job and Family Services, are spread out all over Franklin County. And the people that need those services are spread out all over Franklin County. And when the only mode of public transportation that you have is COTA, that makes it very hard for someone to get services here and here in one day. The other piece that is intertwined with that, Lauren, is that where people live that are experiencing poverty has fanned out across the county too. It used to be concentrated in certain parts of town, and you could also know their demographics based upon where they live. Now, it's not a good thing that that was the case. It just made it easier to deliver services.
The nature of social services is that things change all the time. Contact numbers change. Organizations open and organizations close. The types of programs that they offer changes. A grant runs out, so this is no longer offered. So there's always moving parts. And so people can find resources for themselves, absolutely. But I know in resident services, with our service coordination team, we really try to stay on top of what's out there, what's available. We're constantly shooting an email to the team like, hey, I just learned that this, you know, organization is now offering this service that could benefit a whole bunch of people. And I wouldn't have known about it if I didn't, like, see a comment on somebody's Facebook page about it, you know, because there's not some perfect system of getting that information out. So we try to just keep an ear to the ground. We try to have strong partners that share information so that we have that available for our residents when they call.
These constant changes and fluctuations, getting caught in the cycle of hearing and reporting bad news, things always being unprecedented, putting out fires and more cropping up every day, it's enough to burn someone out of the nonprofit sector altogether.
There's also just a lot going on, and people want to focus on some good stuff for once. We need a moment where we can have some precedented times, and I think people deserve that. It's hard to be in emergency mode all the time. And I think one of the things driving the turnover in our sector is people are tired of being in emergency mode all the time.
Yeah,
I feel that. And I feel like I have the best job in the world, mm-hmm. but I could use a nap. but Lauren, there's a reason why there has been turnover at 65 of our 200 agencies in the CEO spot since February 2020. And it's this stuff.
Burnout.
It's all of this stuff. It just compiles. And maybe it's my fault because I'm a nattering nabob of negativity with all this stuff.
Yeah, your newsletters are just sending people into a spiral.
I think that's right. My team will often have to pull me aside and be like, you need to lighten it up a little bit.
Yeah.
This is dark. But to me, it's really important that we're honest. Mm-hmm. We have to be honest about what's going on. None of that undermines the good or the good people that are doing all of this work. It doesn't negate their efficacy in helping individuals. It just means that we have to do that, but we also have to be the advocates for, let's not make this worse. Let's try to make this better. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very hard when people are so distracted by so many things.
And that's why you always need more hands, because then you can have that time for people to take a break. You know, they take a break and the next people come in. They perform and they meet needs. And then that burnout cycle doesn't happen quite as often.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
It's hard to get hands.
Yep.
as we've discussed.
Absolutely.
Does the work ever cease?
I wish. I always say that the goal of this is to work ourselves out of a job. But
that'd be nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you get burnout?
Not the way that I used to. I've been doing this work for, you know, I've been doing this type of work for a long time. And I even do other social service work when I'm not on the clock at home for it.
Period Pantry.
Yes, I run a nonprofit organization called the Period Pantry in my endless spare time.
Yeah.
and so I am acutely aware of how burnout can happen. So I really just try to be mindful of taking time off and truly taking time off when I take time off, not answering phone calls and sending emails when I'm on vacation, even if vacation is just sitting at home with my family for a day and not going to work. And I think just talking about it, you know, my team has been really great where if you have a really difficult situation or you're just, you know, really fed up with the system, you know, we can talk it through. There's always a lot of different perspectives. And so having that kind of breakdown discussion of whatever's kind of eating at you mm-hmm. about the work, it really is refreshing. And it's been really helpful to kind of mitigate, getting frustrated because, like I've said, there's a lot that I have zero control over. And that can be a little disheartening at times, but just remembering that we have a good team and we do have resources. We do have, you know, potential untapped resources in the community as well. So just using that to stay afloat and always just trying to think of new things and, you know, keep hopeful that, you know, there's a lot of good people out here doing really good work and we'll get there.
And now we break for a side quest.
Okay, you ready?
Uh-huh.
So question one. As of 2021, what percentage of Columbus residents were born outside the U.S.?
I think it's like 18%.
That might be the number today.
Hmm.
The number I have is 13.3.
Okay.
About 120,000 people.
Okay.
Which is cool.
It is. It's very cool. It's one of my favorite things about the city.
Do you have a guess as to which country these residents are typically from?
Like the overall of that
18%? Like the 18, most 30%? Common country they come from. Yeah.
It's got to be Somalia.
That's one of them. That's the second most common.
Let me think then. I don't know.
Bhutan.
Bhutan is more than Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll be darned.
And then Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Myanmar.
Huh.
Yeah.
Are those for new arrivals, or is that overall?
That's overall.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would never have guessed that.
Same. Google, man. This one's fun, and I learned something with this question. In which island country is it common for people to live in prefab houses that are assembled and disassembled really quickly?
That is a fun question. Malaysia.
Japan.
Japan?
Yeah.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. These homes are pretty cool looking, too. I looked up some of the prefab homes, and they do a lot with it. And you can customize and do whatever you want.
That's really neat.
Yeah. Okay. Can you name... This is a pretty easy one. Can you name three of the top five neighborhoods in Columbus?
How do you define top five?
Most popular.
Most popular?
Mm-hmm.
Per, like, the Columbus Underground poll from every year?
Yeah, sure.
It's probably Dublin, Grandview, and... people would probably say Upper Arlington or Worthington. I'll say Worthington.
You got Grandview. Although, I feel like people would fight us on, is Grandview part of Columbus?
They probably would.
People in Grandview are like, we're not Columbus. We're our own thing.
Yep.
Clintonville.
Well, that's part of Columbus. I would have guessed that one. Okay.
Did I fool you with the... Because mm-hmm. I was thinking Columbus proper.
Okay.
Okay, so I gave you Clintonville.
Yep,
name... The rest?
Yeah, now I think I can, since it's Columbus proper, not the burbs. It's got to be Short North and German Village.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And two more.
Oh.
If you want.
For the German Village, Franklinton,
mm-hmm.
and is Campus? Does Campus count?
No. Old Town.
Old Town.
Yeah. Okay, this is your last question.
Okay.
And there's a few that built in.
Okay.
Can you guess... These famous Ohioans, based on a couple context clues.
Okay.
Okay, number one. She's widely considered the greatest gymnast of all time. Most decorated. She has 7 Olympic medals.
Simone Biles.
Yes. Okay, this author is sometimes known
as... Toni Morrison.
No.
Sorry.
Jumped the gun.
I did. Fair enough.
this author is sometimes known as Jovial Bob or Eric Afeby. I had no idea. And he's written over 300 teen mystery and horror books.
Oh, R.L. Stein.
Yep.
Yeah.
Here's an easy one. Okay. This guy is the mayor of Flavortown.
Oh, oh my gosh. I can see his face.
You can see his frosted tips.
I can see everything. And I just can't think of... I'm watching him like take a bite out of something... filled with calories, and I cannot think of his name. He came and he gave Momo Gar great publicity.
Yes.
It's
okay. You know.
I know who it is. I just cannot think of his name right now.
Guy Fieri.
Guy Fieri. Thank you.
Well, I think you did well overall. I'll give you a B+.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming in. This
thanks
is a great conversation.
Me. This was wonderful.
Take care.
Level With Us is brought to you by Homeport and is recorded, mixed, and edited by Lauren Sega. All sources are in the show notes. Homeport creates strong communities by developing quality, affordable homes on a cornerstone of dignity, security, and opportunity. To learn more, or if you'd like to support our mission, visit us at homeportohio.org.